You're listening to BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, the final part of the second memoir of Brian Thompson. His first volume, Keeping Mum, was published in 2006. Clever Girl was published in 2007. Well, this volume has taken in National Service, University at Cambridge, Rock and Roll, and Girls. Suitably confused, Brian did what was considered to be the right thing. He marries the clever girl. The reader is David Troughton.
There may be trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
My Christmas vacation job began the very next day. Passing through Liverpool Street Station on his way to work, my father signed me up as a relief railway porter. It was a long way from Trinity Great Hall, but not as character-forming as he might have wished. Though the job was massively overmanned, we porters remained largely invisible to the travelling public. A seasoned porter called Chaz took me on as his assistant, and we mooched about, sometimes wielding a broom for a few minutes to show willing, but disappearing at the first sign of a passenger with luggage problems. The only time anything like dispatch was shown was the day the royal family set off for Sandringham. Then half the station staff mobbed the train, hustling for the honour of lifting a suitcase. The knack was to avoid the equerries and go for elderly ladies in waiting. "I'm afraid I don't have any coin in my purse," one said.
"Don't you worry about that, Ma. Me and my family wish you and yours a very Merry Christmas."
Blushing, she passed across a green pound note. One evening, Chaz and I were leaning on our brooms and studying the chests of typists staggering home from office parties, when a gaunt figure emerged from the gloom. It was Roy. I swept around his feet with a few passes.
"You know why I'm here," he said. We walked to the end of the platform where the soot and grit met gusts of watery and disappointing snow. "S told me where to find you."
"How is S?"
"You know very well how she is, you rat."
"I love that woman. We have so much in common. We're both Londoners for a start."
"I'm a bloody Londoner."
"You might be now, but university is going to change all that, isn't it? I want you to give her up." I noticed for the first time that Roy was wearing gloves. It was completely irrational, but for some reason this irritated me.
"Get stuffed, Roy."
He jerked back as if slapped, then walked back towards Chaz, beating his temples with his fancy gloves.
"What if I threw myself under a train?" he yelled back at me.
"Not off this platform, you won't, mate," Chaz said.
Instead, he wandered away to a little symphony of door slams, whistles, escaping steam, and the strains of We Wish You a Merry Christmas sung by a children's choir. And so that was it. Roy was toast. S and I set about 3 years of renewed courtship. Our needs had come together like locking pieces of a jigsaw. She wanted to make something of herself in an environment more promising than Enfield, and I had to find the big elsewhere that I could prosper in as my own man. We were partners, therefore, and the commonest way of expressing this was to say we were in love. When I returned to Cambridge, S came down most weekends. Next to the Corn Exchange was a pub called the Red Lion, which had dark and gloomy rooms that smelled of damp wallpaper and flannelette sheets. We lay in bed, shocked at our own depravity. The Red Lion was a practical solution to our need to be together. S had tried visiting me at Mrs. Wilson's, where we lay fully clothed on the bed, terrified at the footfalls on the staircase which might herald the arrival of the ghastly landlady from hell. A cheap room with a sagging mattress was a necessary alternative. We talked. That was not why we went there in the first place,
But what I remember most about that first year of our relationship was the chance to talk and think aloud for the first time. At the end of that year, we celebrated a good result in prelims with a ticket to the May Ball, as formal an occasion as either of us had ever attended. At midnight, we took a punt and poled slowly past King's, champagne cooling on the end of a string. S, I think, remembers those Cambridge days as halcyon. Such a world as we inhabited at weekends was probably never to come our way again. In October 1956, the RAF bombed Egyptian airbases after Nasser seized the Suez Canal. In November, I joined an anti-war protest march in Cambridge. I had signed a paper petitioning the government to abandon its policy and declaring that I would refuse to serve with the colours were I to be recalled. A fortnight later, my father was interviewed at work by security officers from MI5. As he had signed the Official Secrets Act and was working on classified projects, they wanted to know what he thought his son was doing.
"I told them you were as dangerous as dog shit," he said contemptuously.
It was the end of a very complicated year of my life. If I was not yet married, nor even engaged, a room in the Red Lion was as binding as a wedding ring. And the key date in my life was September 1958, when, as they say, S and I would walk down the aisle together. Meanwhile, I was an unwanted lodger in the family home. And, worst of all, I had discovered the limits of my academic ability. So far as Cambridge was concerned, I was boxing above my weight. In the summer of 1957, I took a vacation job in the offices of Taylor Woodrow in London. And so it was that for nearly 4 months, I joined S and my father on the commuter trains. I was never going to make serious money. S might. They loved her at the bank. But I persuaded my father to let me keep a month's salary from Taylor Woodrow, and one afternoon we bought an antique engagement ring from a jeweller's in Wigmore Street. For both of us, it was a red-letter day. In a year's time, we would be married and irreproachably our own people. I asked George for his daughter's hand, long after taking the rest of her, but there was a point of etiquette in this. It seemed that we could not simply buy an engagement ring and flaunt it about without the formality of trapping her poor father in the parlour and forcing him to turn off the early evening western. "Well," he murmured, "who knows but what you might be able to make something of her." When I told my father, he reached for his packet of senior service. We were in the kitchen. Upstairs, my mother was in bed and had not been seen for 2 days. "All these books," he said, "and you still talk like a bloody shop girl. If you marry next year, you'll live to regret it. What do you want from your life?"
"I want to be happy." "I know you tell people I couldn't care less about you. That's not true. But wanting to be happy is such a sissy way of talking. There's only one thing that's going to change your life."
"And what's that?"
"Work."
"Having children doesn't count."
"Any bloody fool can have children. Don't come babbling to me in 10 years' time."
"Is that the sort of advice you were given when you married Mum?"
He threw his cigarette into the sink. "I thought with us it'd be different," he said bleakly.
In my final year at Trinity, I was given a room in New Court, near the river. It was the last time in my life that I could, if I chose, spend the day entirely alone. Some people thrive on that. I did not. S explained that I was suffering from my mother's melancholia.
"Nobody expects you to be perfect except your father. You're what I want, and that ought to be enough. Can we please stop looking at things as though life's something you only read about in books? In a few months' time, we'll be married. You'll be teaching, and everything else will fall into place."
"You're right," I said, kissing her.
I'd had an interview for a teaching place in Shrewsbury. I had already asked S whether she wanted us to make a lot of money or live in some nice places. Nice places won. My father, who had never wanted me to go to Cambridge in the first place, was only too willing to bring me away. I had my stuff ready, but just before he was due to arrive, there was a knock at the door. I opened it to find Figgy standing beside a pushchair. "How did you know where to find me?" I asked, amazed. "That's what porters' lodges are for." "But I'm leaving today." "I know." We kissed either side of the baby's pushchair. "You couldn't have got in touch earlier." She nodded down at her son, huge tears in her eyes. I made her walk with me along the backs. We sat with our arms around each other on a bench overlooking a row of willows. "You know I'm getting married in September." She kissed me. "I go to evening classes," she said absently. "Did you know?" She shook her head. "No, but that's what happens. People do, don't they? I just wanted to see you one more time, for old time's sake." "You said something about evening classes." "Badminton. But I have done literature." We kissed for the last time, and then she walked away without turning back. The baby's arm waved goodbye. That summer, I worked in the carnation shed of a local nursery. We clocked on at 5 in the morning to cut blooms for dispatch to Covent Garden. The charge hand was a pleasant bloke, and when he learned I was earning to get married, wangled me an extra 2 hours cutting nettles. At the end of September, I finished at the nursery on the Thursday. 2 days later, I was married. And the day after the wedding, S and I were in Shrewsbury. S was right. It was a strange and somehow awesome thing to be married. We were one day into the new world, much like emigrants from the old country, standing on the dock with only our brains and passions for company and everything before us. "Aren't you going to wear pajamas?" S asked as we got ready for bed. "Until a month ago, I'd never owned pajamas." "But you have some now. I think you should." Next morning, I pulled on my new sports jacket, hitched up my brown corduroy trousers, hefted my briefcase under my arm, kissed the wife goodbye, and so disguised, set off to the local grammar school. As I drew nearer, the pavement became cluttered with other new boys, distinguishable by their recent haircuts, satchels, and shiny shoes. We walked into the school together, until the point came where I walked on alone, tramping up some steps to the staff room. It was nerve-wracking. But, according to the missus, we would be having sausages for tea.
Clever Girl, A Sentimental Education was written by Brian Thompson and produced by Amber Barnfather. Well, things turn a bit seasonal after the weekend with Santa Alive, when Jeremy Seal's quest to discover the real St. Nicholas takes him from Santa's kingdom in Birmingham to Turkey.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Good afternoon from me, Jim Lee. Well, it's the drama next, set in the Highlands. The story of two brothers at loggerheads over their inheritance during the turbulent years of the Jacobite Rebellion. That's The Master of Ballantrae. In the 4 o'clock show, Mel Gedroych gets a guide to making the perfect frilly frock with the Strictly Come Dancing costumier. And later, you can hear a new 6-part comedy show hosted by Frank Skinner, all about history. The rest is history, tonight at 10. So now we begin a two-part drama in which two brothers, James and Henry, begin a deadly power struggle that is set to continue for many years to come, as Bonnie Prince Charlie raises an army to rid Scotland of the English.
The Master of Ballantrae by Robert Louis Stevenson. Dramatised by Chris Dolan. Episode 1.
Heads, I go. Shield, I stay.
This is madness.
You're the master of this household, James. If anyone goes off fighting, it should be your brother.
Will you stand by the fall of it?
I will.
Heads.
No!
I will join Prince Charles, Edward Stuart.
This will hit Father hard. You know he loves you best.
And if you loved me...